morning, everyone. Good to see you all. Those that I can't see, I'd love to see your faces. It would be nice to see your faces, but I understand some people don't want that, but it's okay. We accept every face. We love every face. So, this week's parsha is called Mishpatim, which means basically laws that are available to us through reason. And it's been put into our Exodus, the Exodus narrative, to follow the giving of the 10 sayings that we read about last week. The proximity of the two is in order to imbue, if you will, these laws with the sense that they are indeed divinely commanded. But yet we understand that these things are really the blueprint for creating a society once they enter the land of Canaan. Remember the story, I'm sure many of you do, but at this point in the story, they are ready to go up to the land of Canaan, and it's going to be within a few weeks or a few months, but it's certainly not the 40-year trek that happens only later on. People often confuse that, think that they were destined to have the 40-year wandering, but that's another story for another time. So I was interested in the idea of law in general, and who and the law giver. So, you know, as is our want here, as we often go into some Buddhist sources, and I found their marvelous collection on Buddhism and law, which is it's an academic book with different articles with different aspects of it. But what is fascinating about it is even though we would think that Buddhism is somehow free of any kind of those restrictions of any kind, there is a whole tradition of Vinaya in Buddhism, which means the way one lives in a monastic society. There are rules of how one acts and in that monastic society. And of course, as because there are rules, it's because there's also transgressions. I often wonder when do the rules come after the transgressions? I have a feeling, yes. I have a feeling there have been many transgressions, so you create a law thing. Right? And I think that's true of all law. All law, as people who have studied me know over the years, law follows life. Life does not follow law, right? You create a society and you realize that certain things are really good and you want to really preserve them. So you make it a law. And we have the same thing in our society. Stop signs. You could arrive at stop signs without a law, but I assume a lot of people, a lot of oxen and those days were hitting each other maybe at the intersection. So you make a law. And now you can get a citation if you do not observe the law. So life is there, and we want to preserve what we think is helpful. And we also, unfortunately, want to prohibit things that we think are detrimental. So this parsha is a miscellany of law. It's not always that consistent. There are interruptions. I won't go into the idea of how I think it all developed, but the idea is that basically in order to create a civil society, you must have frameworks. And that happened in Buddhism in the monastic society in order to create, if you will, a powerful monastic society. So I want to talk about two things today. And one is the issue of Torah and Dharma. Now, for us, Torah and Dharma are have many different understandings and many different definitions. However, in the Buddhist triad and in the Jewish triad, we have a trinity, if you will. The Jewish triad is God, Torah, and Israel, and in the Buddhist, it's Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And they're very interestingly similar. We found particularly the idea of liking threes. There's a lot of threes that, particularly in Tibetan Buddhism, which makes it easier than twos, which create dichotomy. And as you know, threes have the capacity of maybe some synthesis. So Torah and Dharma. So what does Torah do and what does Dharma do? Dharma basically connects the sense of where we go for refuge. In the case of Buddhism, the refuge is the Buddha. in our tradition, the refuge is however we understand God. And it connects, if you will, between that, if you will, source of authority to the last of the triad. In the case of Buddhism, it's Sangha, community, and in our tradition, Israel, again, as a sense of community. So what is Dharma? Well, Dharma basically is a way of expanding our comprehension of what it means to be in a, if you will, a drama, a divine drama. And all of our lives, basically, I believe, are divine dramas. But it unites us as well. Torah, it becomes a platform, and it stops being only the text of Torah that we know, the five books, but it also becomes a way of life, a Torah style, a Torah nature, if you will. And in the Buddhism, it also has expanded from just the monastic laws to somehow having a Dharma nature. And we can, of course, spend some time talking about that in a little while. But I just wanted to say that basically we want to connect in both of our traditions, but certainly in our tradition, to connect the capacity of the Sangha of Israel to be the where we play out Dharma, and we really make it into something that is beyond just a text. And this is true in Buddhism as well as in Judaism. It unites the people in both traditions with a sense of common destiny and its connection to that which is in our tradition the one, and in the Buddhist tradition, the no one, or the none. You know, I have a friend who was a Jewish Buddhist, a Buju, and he said, look, what's the big difference? You say one, I say none. Let's not let an N stand between us. And of course, I believe the goal, certainly in our tradition, is that this triad, of this dynamic, if you want to call it, I think it's a very dynamic thing. It's not something that remains static, is basically helping us become, if you will, I know it's a tough thing to do, helps us to become a mensch. And what's a mensch? Well, a mensch is a person who is responsive and also is willing to take responsibility. Responsiveness and responsibility. So the test of this is creating a society and making it work. And we, our job, I believe, if we have a task, I believe, is to bring mind and heart together to create such a society. Because there are many differing paths, but still we basically believe, not believe, we basically take as a given in our tradition that the law is liberating, and you need to have law in order to truly be able to be, if you will, free. The law will make you free. They play with this, of course, when you go back to the Exodus story at the beginning, when Moshe and Aaron go before Pharaoh, they say, let my people go. But everybody forgets the next word. That's really a problem in a way. And the next word is, so they shall serve me. So serving this divine essence, however you want to understand it, is basically different than worshiping a human being, the Pharaoh, or, if you will, other forms of idolatry. They play with the word cherut, which means freedom. And they say, well, the freedom only arrives when it was charut. Harut, using the same shoresh, the same root, which means engraved upon what? Engraved upon the tablets. So that's how cherut really develops. We can be true to ourselves, and we basically, by doing so, we have the capacity to basically, if you will, free ourselves. And I think that's something we try to do in our practice, is to free ourselves from misconceptions, from not seeing things as they are, for craving for things to be the way we want it to be, etc. A big essential difference between Buddhism and Judaism in this realm is that, of course, Buddhism is developed as in a monastic society, and it took a very long time and not yet totally there to be what we would call Judaism as a society of householders. We are, Jews, have taken on, perhaps something that's quite hard to do, taken on the idea that we can be a holy people, that we, through our actions, really can elevate ourselves, and that everyone, it's certainly true in the rabbinic period, that everyone has the capacity to study, to learn, to be, if you will, aware of how mitzvot, how these imperatives. I like to understand mitzvah as an imperative rather than something that comes from outside. But we, in our practice, create a sense that, oh yes, I have to act this way in order to maintain my sense of what it means to be a human being. So Torah, both Torah and Dharma, are an image that I came to my mind in talking about this was, they're like a ladle drawing from a stream of living consciousness that passes us by and pouring that consciousness into us little by little, just enough so we can stay firm in the flowing river of impermanence. And I would hope that all of us have this this in mind when we talk about law. I know many of us are antinomian. We don't want laws. We want to do what we won't want to do. We want to be, if you will, free agents. And that's true. But if we believe in the Sangha, in the idea of community, of Yisrael, Klal Yisrael, a very important term, the complexity of Israel, that we are connected to each other, Arevim Zebazeh, responsible for each other, and so in the Sangha, responsible to each other, if we indeed want to adapt that as part of our life, we truly can find not only a, if you will, a connection to the divine, but you find a connection to the articulation of the divine or the incarnation of the divine, which are human beings in our tradition. So I didn't have a lot of time to go into this in a deeper way, but I would like to open up that discussion about our relationship to law, our relationship to mitzvot, and what does it mean when you have mitzvot that you find quite disturbing. And in this miscellany, you have a range of so many laws talking about murder, talking about slavery, talking about, if you will, being kind to the stranger and being kind to widows and orphans, all these things that we can take on very easily. But then we have things that we find appalling from our modern sensibilities, wizards and witches should die, et cetera, and other things about talking about how one should be punished. And I think many of these sayings like mot yumat, that you will die, is there not because it wants to kill you, but it wants to be a deterrent. It's like, in a sense, we have capital punishment on the books. However, I'm against capital punishment because I think when you say capital punishment, you're talking it and hoping it is a deterrent. But of course, we know that that's not the case, but whatever it is. So I'll open it up a little bit today, and I know it's a bit loose, but hopefully that will be inviting to you to add your comments and words to this, because ultimately I think we're the ones who are going to be creating mitzvot and Torah, different kinds of mitzvot. Now we have a great movement within Judaism and other traditions to talk about the mitzvot to prevent climate change. It's no longer something theoretical. It basically says, no, we are in a sense, I'm trying to use the word, we are commanded, if you will, in order to have a future. We are commanded now to act in a certain way vis-a-vis the planet. There's also a lot of work in eco-kashrut, etc. So there's a lot of people who, within our community, who basically take advantage of the fact that we have a mitzvah system to extend what mitzvah is. Now, by the way, the word mitzvah, let me, for those who are not acquainted with it, is often translated as a commandment, but it's really, that's a misnomer. It sort of puts people off. What do you mean commanded? Because most Jews, I say, and I say this with due respect, do not believe there's a commander. So if there's no commander, how are you commanded? But if you take the Aramaic root to the word safta, safta is the same root of tziva, tziva, safta, and there it means being able to bring together, to join. So when it says, Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav, who has made us special or given us a sense of ourselves, is done through a mitzvah which allows me to connect with. And I like that a lot better than command. because I think that's what many of us are searching for in our lives, is deeper connection. And I think that really is a real mitzvah, to have that deeper connection, that seeing what I articulate in my life, the actions I take are in some way connecting me to not only my tradition, my history, customs of other people, but also connecting me to the source of life. And the Mekor Chaim, the source of life, is really something that we basically have to constantly, while we continue to practice, we have to become fully aware of that, become conscious, etc. A lot of people, as you know, may not be conscious, even though they're alive, but they may not be conscious. So that's part of what our struggle is, our fight, our demand that we have upon ourselves, is not to get inundated by the lack of consciousness that is so much around us, but to hopefully not only develop it in ourselves, but hopefully to spread the word that, yes, there is something deep within each human being that allows us to do mitzvot, which allow us to connect with each other. I'll stop there and open it up. I think I made a mistake and didn't record that. Did someone else record it? I hope so.
Yes.
Because I have to say it again now. I don't want to say it again. So I don't know.
I recorded it, Reb Moshe.
Oh, good. So now you can stop the recording and we can just have an open discussion, and you will not be recorded. Okay, so feel free to say anything.